Welcome to the Bloomberg Law Podcast. I'm June Grosso. Every day we bring you insight and analysis into the most important legal news of the day. You can find more episodes of the Bloomberg Law Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, and on Bloomberg.com/podcasts. President Trump continues his attack on the Mueller probe, repeating a certain phrase over and over.
I think that we're being hurt very badly by the, rigged witch hunt.
But the Trump White House is not the first administration to use the witch hunt epithet. It was actually used by Democratic political strategist Paul Begala during the Clinton administration. Joining me is William Banks, professor at Syracuse University Law School. Bill, a Bloomberg story today details the similarities between Trump's approach to the growing talk of impeachment and Clinton's approach. Tell us about some of those.
Well, I think the Begala statement is similar to some that the president has made. Of course, we were in a pre-Twitter age, but he managed to get the word out just the same. You know, we forget that the President Clinton was really in very deep trouble. Of course, the nature of the conduct that was that produced the articles of impeachment against him were entirely unlike those that might be brought eventually against President Trump. It's his personal conduct having nothing to do with his conduct of the office itself. And I think that's the most important distinction to keep in mind when we're comparing these. It's really apples and oranges. If anything, the Trump case is looking much more like the Nixon case.
But do you think this is a deliberate strategy adopted from the Clinton playbook or happenstance?
I think it's probably happenstance, and I think when the president repeats these catchphrases over and over again, he's simultaneously trying to appeal to his base and also to let his those who are sort of taking the fall for him, like Manafort, know that he's got their back, that he'll be there for them, that he'll issue a pardon if that is needed, or he'll otherwise try to stand in the way of their being prosecuted.
Let's turn now to a man who refused to fire Robert Mueller and is apparently now, shall we say, being escorted to the exit by Trump, White House counsel Don McGahn. Some top Republican leaders expressed disappointment at the departure, but there were strains in the relationship with Trump. What does this tell you about Trump and what's important to him?
Well, I think there have been strains. Now it's well over a year since McGahn threatened to resign if Trump fired Mueller, or if he insisted that Attorney General Sessions not recuse himself. I think that McGahn could read the political tea leaves far better than the president. He also knew, of course, the legal bounds for what the president might do. So I think the president here is he's happy to see Mr. McGahn go in some ways, because McGahn speaks truth to power. He pushed back against the president on many occasions, and Trump has increasingly let people go who are not willing to just go along with his gut instincts.
McGahn also helped shepherd a lot of federal judicial nominees in the conservative mold through the courts and through the process, and has managed to help Mitch McConnell present a more conservative federal judiciary.
I think that's right, and I think you could say that McGahn is probably responsible for one of the single most effective initiatives of the Trump presidency. The conservative judges now, there are about 60 appointees, I believe, since Trump took office. And McGahn has been very smart, very strategic, and very inclusive in terms of finding the candidates for judgeships that will both be appropriately conservative and be appealing to the senators who need to vote yes. So that's going to be a legacy, I think, that he will enjoy. That's why Senators McConnell and Grassley and others are so troubled by his departure.
Let's talk about possible people to fill this vacancy of Don McGahn. Megan Delrahim, who's the top antitrust official has been mentioned as a possible replacement. Also, Trump's in-house counsel, Emmett Flood, who actually represented Clinton during his impeachment hearings. What is your take on those two names?
I don't know much about the former. I think Flood would be McGahn's choice and obviously has directly relevant experience. He's a very seasoned lawyer. But again, like McGahn, he might be one who would speak truth to power. And I'm not sure the president wants another lawyer in his inner circle who's going to stand up to him. We'll have to see.
So you mentioned Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Trump has been targeting him in tweets and statements ever since he recused himself from the Russia probe. There are indications that Trump might actually fire him after the midterms. Would that put us on the road to a Saturday night massacre type situation? Because the real goal seems to be to stop the Russia probe.
Yeah, but of course it depends on timing, where Mr. Mueller is with his own work at that particular time, the results of the election as well, the prospects for articles of impeachment. It's possible that we'd have something like a Saturday night massacre. By that, of course, you're referencing the litany of top lawyers who resigned rather than follow President Nixon's instructions in 1972. If Trump is cagey, and he will be between now and then, he'll make sure that those who are below Sessions are more likely to simply follow his political directives than Mr. Sessions is.
So is the best route for those who want to see Mueller finishing his investigation to pass some kind of legislation then, which has been tried?
Yes. I mean, you know, that should have been done a long time ago. It's not going to happen before the election. There's no appetite for it among the Republicans. As we've seen, almost no Republicans have spoken out when the president makes these comments now about Sessions. Even those who did earlier, have now been silenced for whatever reason. And, there simply aren't the votes.
Well, we are going to continue, as we've been talking about this, for quite some time, and I suspect quite some time in the future. Thanks so much, Bill. That's William Banks. He's a professor at Syracuse University Law School. Don McGahn is going to be staying at the White House as White House counsel through the confirmation hearings of Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. He also shepherded Neil Gorsuch on his way to the Supreme Court. And as we mentioned, he has been responsible for coordinating with Mitch McConnell many of the conservative judicial appointments to the federal bench. Put up or shut up. That's what Exxon's lawyer said New York's attorney general should do in its investigation of the company for misleading investors about the financial impact of climate change. Ted Wells made that remark in court during a heated exchange with lawyers from the AG's office over producing internal corporate documents. Joining me is Charles Warren, head of the environmental law practice at Cramer Levin. Chuck, Exxon has really been on the offensive trying to shut down this investigation. It's hard to keep track of all the legal skirmishes here. Tell us about them.
Yes, June. Well, it's been going on for a few years, and essentially what happened was that first the New York State Attorney General's office sued both ExxonMobil and its accountants to try and get documents about the accounting and reporting of, oil and gas reserves, evaluation of assets, write-downs, and energy price projection and sort of carbon cost estimates, all stuff that they said that the company was basically keeping two sets of books, one internally and one that was sent out to the shareholders when they talked about the cost of climate change. And so that's been going on, and Exxon tried to use the accountant-client privilege, which the court said no to. They have turned over some documents, and now the latest exchange was, Exxon's been saying since the beginning that they believe this is politically motivated, and of course the Attorney General's office has denied that. And the latest exchange, which you referred to, was they'd been given some documents to the Attorney General's office. They they're saying we need to look at more before we'll know whether there's basically financial fraud here that we want to sue them on.
Chuck,
and so that's really where things stand now after all this jockeying around. And the judge seemed like he's getting, saying, hey, at some point you have to make a decision here whether you're going to sue or not sue.
The judge, Barry Ostrager, said, you've been investigating for 2 years, so either you're going to file a case or you're not going to file a case.
Right.
Can a federal judge tell the AG when to stop investigating something?
Well, not really in the sense, but I think what he's saying to them, look, you've got to make a decision here, and they're saying, we have a number of documents, but there's still things that we need. I think he's just trying to press them, and but I think I don't think he's going to try to, you know, obviously he could say I'm going to dismiss the case if he said, you know, if you don't come up with anything because it's been going on for too long.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think he would do that. I think in the end he's trying to push them to make a decision as soon as they can, and they're saying we need some further documents, but we're close to making a decision. That's my sense.
The AG says there's smoking gun evidence and something to do with Rex Tillerson. So is it that they know the evidence is there, but they can't get it?
Well, I think that they believe the evidence is there, but they still haven't. You know, the Exxon's been trying to throw up as many roadblocks as possible for them to get information, and they have gotten some information, but then they haven't gotten all of the information, and I think that's what they think. If once they get all the information, they may have heard from people inside the company that when Tillerson was chairman, he knew that there was a discrepancy in the figures internally versus what was going out publicly, but you know, it didn't bother him, and I assume, just from what I've read, although I don't know, that they have been talking to people who from the, you know, inside, who had heard that on the inside.
So Exxon is fighting a similar battle with the Massachusetts AG.
Correct.
Or has been.
Yes.
And there's a lot of delay, but are they actually winning in any of these cases? I mean, what's their record, so to speak?
No, they're not winning in the sense that they're being required to turn over documents. They're trying to lay the groundwork, which I think is hard to do in a case that say, you know, these cases are politically motivated. And I think that, you know, because it's the Attorney General of New York and the Attorney General of Massachusetts, and they're saying, you know, basically these are states that are after them for political purposes. But in my experience, those arguments don't get you that far. Because they have a right, you know, the attorneys general of the states of Massachusetts and New York have a right to make this kind of investigation under their own state securities laws and to get the information. And in the end, Exxon's going to have to turn it over. I think they're just trying to, as I said, you know, pressure the state to make a decision and do something, and trying to say it's just, the reason they're not is politically motivated. But I think in the end, they're going to have to turn over stuff to the both offices.
Chuck, there are so many climate change lawsuits, and the climate change lawsuit in New York City was dismissed. Are most of them moving forward, or are there obstacles?
I think it depends on the kind of lawsuit that you're talking about. I think, as we've discussed before, climate change lawsuits where they try to use the common law or different types of ways to attack climate change have not been successful because, you know, essentially the courts have said, you know, from the Supreme Court on down, that, you know, regulation of this type of stuff is really under the Clean Air Act. But this is slightly different. And this is looking at it from a securities perspective and state law securities. And this is where states who have these kinds of statutes, like New York, it's called the Martin Act, they can investigate and sue someone for securities fraud, in effect. because you're not failing to disclose things to your shareholders that you ought to disclose.
All right. Thanks so much, Chuck. That's Charles Warren. He's head of the environmental law practice at Kramer Levin. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Law Podcast. You can subscribe and listen to the show on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, and on Bloomberg.com/podcasts. I'm June Grosso. This is Bloomberg.